Welcome back to the show, geeks. I have a topic that I am really psyched to do this week. We're having some pretty bad weather here on the East Coast in the Mid-Atlantic region, so I'm blowing through these podcasts one right after the other. But this one in particular, I'm very excited to talk about. So about a year ago, I spent some time in the city of Canberra, Australia. It's the capital city of the country of Australia. And for a capital city, it was kind of subdued. There wasn't really a lot going on. The region is kind of spread out, so you can take buses, but there are some areas that actually the buses don't even go to that you'd still really like to see. So my activity, my extracurricular activity in the city kind of consisted to going to a few local hotspots that were just always jam-packed. And one of these places was a little bar called The Phoenix. It was a very small bar that had bands that would play, small bands, but the place was just jam-packed every single night. They would have all these kind of old-timey, kind of crazy pictures on the wall. It was a very artsy place. And because of the crowd, I ended up being kind of jammed up against a wall, and I started looking at some of these pictures, and one in particular caught my eye. You could tell it was a pretty old photo, but it was still in color. I could see that there was a date on it. It was 1915. But what really caught my eye was the color of the building, what was on top, and the marquee. The whole building was red, including this gigantic red windmill on top of the building. And it kind of sat smashed between other establishments right next door. But the marquee read Moulin Rouge. If you're a fan of seeing movies, then surely you've heard that name before. It was a pretty famous movie in 2001 called Moulin Rouge. But ever since I saw that photo, I've had this passing interest in this very notorious place. Picking up little bits of information here and there, and like every other topic that I get into, I start with a little bit of knowledge and I expand my way out to kind of get the full picture of what this whole thing was all about. And what I ended up when I got the content pulled together for this one was something that was much more interesting than I really could have imagined going into it. So going into it, you kind of think of a place like the Moulin Rouge as being an establishment that was a bit too overhyped. Maybe there wasn't as much to it. And that may be true to some degree for the Moulin Rouge. But we're going to get into that in just a minute. So let's start with the basics. Where was this place? Well, the Moulin Rouge was located in Paris, France. Anybody who's seen the 2001 movie is probably pretty familiar with the Eiffel Tower in the background and all that. But the Moulin Rouge sits on a street that borders a district called the Montmartre District. So now that we have a general idea of where it was, what was it exactly? Well, what it was specifically was it was a dance hall slash cabaret. It was an entertainment venue. There were a lot of these things at the time. There were a lot of dance halls and cabarets that had existed before this time, so the idea of the Moulin Rouge was nothing really new. Nor was the idea of a cabaret. So if you're new to this concept of a cabaret, it's a very, very old idea. The word goes all the way back to 1655. But you can almost think of a cabaret as sort of like a variety show that served dinner, maybe there was some comedy involved, some maybe a little bit of drama, there was usually some nudity involved at some capacity. But it was just generally a place to go to have a really good time, if you were living back at that time. You could still go to cabarets, there are some around. It's worth going to see one. So the establishment was founded in 1889 and opened its doors on October 5th of that year. It was sort of a joint venture between these two guys named Charles Zidler and Joseph Aller. Joseph Aller was really the main brains behind the operation, with Zidler being kind of like a business partner, so to speak. And from what I was able to pick up about Aller was he was kind of a shady dude. He had actually come up with this new betting scheme, which is called Paris Mutuel. It's actually still used in horse racing today, but basically what it is that you take a bet, you put it all in one big pot where the tax is and the rake is all taken off, and then the odds are also calculated off of that main pot of money that everybody puts in for. But he spent a few days in jail over this gambling scheme. It was still illegal when he had founded it. But eventually he starts taking interest in entertainment venues. And that interest really picks up in 1876. But the aim of these two guys was to create what they would describe as a temple dedicated to women and the can-can. Now I've said a word there that you probably are familiar with, especially in the context of the Moulin Rouge, the can-can. It's sort of hard to separate the two, actually. There is a little bit of misinformation about how the two relate. But some people believe that the can-can was actually invented at the Moulin Rouge. The can-can was really not invented at the Moulin Rouge. It was already a pretty popular music hall dance when the Moulin Rouge had opened in 1889. And what the can-can was it was a dance that would usually be performed by women. In fact, exclusively by women from everything I've read. I can't really imagine a man doing the can-can anyway. I would hope not to see something like that. So the women who were performing the can-can would have these crazy large petticoats on, petticoats like a dress, with all kinds of layers underneath. They'd usually wear black stockings, and they would kick their legs up into the air and give a kind of a peek at what's underneath. The way you're probably used to seeing it is that the women would line up, they'd all have the stockings and the petticoats on, they'll all kick in time together. And so for a dance that, even before the Moulin Rouge was created, was a very sexually suggestive dance for that time period, the reason that the can-can would gain so much fame at the Moulin Rouge for both the dance and the venue was thanks to a lot of different elements that just happened to come together at the Moulin Rouge. Now, you're not going to see any video of any of these old-time can-can dancers doing their thing at the Moulin Rouge, but suffice to say, the way that they did it at the Moulin Rouge was even more sexualized than the way that the dance was generally done. And one of these guides I was able to find, it's a flyer for the city of Paris, like Things to Do in Paris in 1898, describes the dancers of the Moulin Rouge as an army of young girls who were there to dance with elasticity when launching their leg in the air that leaves us to predict a moral flexibility, at least. So in regards to the sexuality of the dance, you have women putting their legs up into the air, which is one way, you know. And you also have this innuendo that because they can so easily put their legs into the air, that must mean that their morals are probably a little bit loose too, you know what I mean? Like their legs. That's the joke. But the Moulin Rouge would also give us another piece of this archetype that we have on the can-can. And that's with the musical taste of the venue itself. They really like to play music by a composer named Jacques Offenbach. And one song in particular, which is called Orpheus in the Underworld. It's the one that we most associate with the can-can. Probably wasn't the only song that they played with the can-can dance at the Moulin Rouge, but it's the one that we associate most commonly. I'm sure you've heard it before, but that's another one of those things that lent itself to the fame of this matching of the place and the music and the dance. But probably one of the biggest advantages that the Moulin Rouge had that allowed it to be a hit with the people in the country of France, and more specifically in the city of Paris. A lot had changed over the last century in France, before the Moulin Rouge was created, that caused the society in general to change in a very big way, especially the city of Paris. In the last 100 years, you had seen a country that was ruled by a monarchy lose its monarchy, the elite classes were literally purged with the guillotine, and so this whole idea of an equal society really started to push its way into the mainstream, violently. You also had the coming of the Industrial Age. And so to go along with the revolutionary attitude that you had in France, with the fall of their monarchy, the replacement with Napoleon, the fall of Napoleon, the mashing of these classes together into one super class where everybody's equal, right, supposedly, and free, was married with the idea of the Industrial Revolution. This time of excess spending where people were making money, businesses were starting to grow, and people had a little bit more free time before this era that they could spend on something frivolous, like going to the music halls. And 1889 just happened to be a really great year for this particular venue to open. 1889 was actually, you could almost call it the year of Paris. Because not only was the Moulin Rouge opening, which would be an icon in coming years, and was popular right away, by the way, Paris was also hosting the World's Fair that year, and so the Eiffel Tower was actually built that very same year that the Moulin Rouge opened. You also have a congregation of writers and artists and philosophers all coming to the same area in Paris, this Montmartre area. And so all of these ideas, which we refer to generally now as bohemian, have all come together in this one place, with the Moulin Rouge being sort of the centerpiece of that entire bohemian movement. The Bohemian movement is something that we would probably consider these days to, like, the hippie movement of the 1960s, or you might call these people hipsters today. They're all very preoccupied with their various different forms of art. But you end up seeing a lot of these establishments throughout history kind of pop up, like Studio 54 in New York was the icon of the 1970s, the disco era. The Moulin Rouge is another one of these places that just served to be the focal point of this bohemian culture in the way that a place like 54 did for that particular disco culture. But the real magic of the Moulin Rouge was with the people. So like I was saying before, this place was like a cabaret, so it was a place to go and have a good time, blow off some steam. But it was like a nightclub times a thousand. They employed a lot of women there as dancers, but you'll see them referred to as courtesans a lot. And that's a term that's been used and changed a lot over the years, but basically what it means is that these women were probably also prostitutes on the side. They were good time girls, you know, they would dance because they liked to dance. And if they were paid to have sex too, well, then that was just part of that time and that place. But it is worth keeping in mind that the Moulin Rouge was probably used as often as a brothel as it was a place of dance and just general debauchery. So the Moulin Rouge employed a lot of women there, a lot of just different people. There were men involved as well that were employed there, although I couldn't find anything that really specifically said that the men acted as prostitutes. But most of the women that they employed to dance were really just dancers, like backup dancers. They would have actually a main show. But the Moulin Rouge was also known for its personalities, the stars of their shows. One of these people that you can absolutely not separate from the Moulin Rouge, and forgive me because I'm going to try on my French accent here just for fun, was a post-impressionist artist named Henri Toulouse-Lautrec. Toulouse-Lautrec was the archetype for the bohemian artist. He was drawn to this Montmartre quarter of Paris for its artistry and the general bohemian lifestyle. It had become pretty well known around the country that this was the place to go if you were into that sort of lifestyle. And he would become very famous. His whole fame would be based on his paintings that he would do of the dancers and patrons of the Moulin Rouge. But one of the downfalls of this guy was that he was very short, and that actually led him to have a lot of interpersonal problems that he chose to deal with alcohol. One of these dancers that he started to form his fame based on was a woman named La Goulue. Her real name was Louise Weber, and she also had another nickname. Her other nickname was the Queen of Montmartre. Now, Weber was born into poverty. Her mother was a laundress, so her job was to clean other people's clothes. I sort of think of Charlie Bucket's mother from the old Willy Wonka movie. And so women from all the various rungs of society would bring their laundry to her, and she would clean them and then return them. And so Louise Weber would have this habit of sneaking out of the house in some of her mother's customers' expensive dresses to go dancing in. When she grew up, though, she was a little bit overweight, but she was just as comfortable in clothes as she was out of clothes. I would also suggest that if you're going to do image searches, be a little bit careful about looking up Louise Weber, because she actually did have some nude photos taken of her. So if you want to see her naked, you can. They're black and white. I mean, they're part of the image search that you can get on Google. But even when she had clothes on, she would usually wear something that was pretty provocative, even by our standards today. If you want to see what I mean, you can actually look up the paintings that Toulouse-Lautrec did of her and get a better feel for just the kind of person that she was to look at. But like I said, there are photographs as well. And don't be scared off by the nude stuff, because she's also got pictures where she's in clothes as well. But Weber was one of the early adopters of the Moulin Rouge. She was one of the first dancers in the club, and she was instantly popular. And the biggest reason that she was so popular and why she was put as the star of the show was because her shows were outrageous. One of the things that she was well known for is that she would kick her leg up in the air during the can-can and kind of like swirl her petticoat around so that you could see the heart embroidered in her panties. Another story says that she noticed the Prince of Wales, Albert Edward, who was the son of Queen Victoria and Albert, in the club one night, and she shouted out to him, "Hey, Wales! Invite us to champagne." Basically what she was saying was, "Hey, Prince, go buy us some champagne." Not really the most proper thing to say to a customer of royalty in the way that he was, but that's the kind of person she was. She was very loud and very outspoken. She sounded like she would have been a lot of fun to have around. But her nickname, La Goulue, was given to her because of a particular habit that she had. You see, one of the things that she would do is while she was doing the can-can, she would kick one of the patrons' hats off, and then she would reach down and grab his drink and just slam it while she was doing her dance. which led to the nickname La Goulue, which means the glutton in French. So Weber spends 3 years with the Moulin Rouge before she decides to part ways with the club, and she leaves in 1892. Her departure in and of itself was the end of an era for the Moulin Rouge, and they really needed to find somebody else to fill that gap. And they were able to fill that gap with another dancer named Jeanne Avril. Her real name was Jeanne Boudon, and she was asked to take over for La Goulue when she left, which would have been very big shoes to fill. Boudon herself came from a house that abused her as a girl, and some of the documentation that I was able to find said that when she was younger, she had a problem with jerky movements and sudden contortions, and I'm not exactly sure what that means. I don't know if that means seizures or what, but she eventually runs away from home, and she ends up in the hospital for whatever this problem that she had was. The doctors at that time called it St. Vitus dance, but we today would call it Sydenham's chorea. What ends up happening with her, though, is during her time in the hospital, she's invited to this dance for the patients and the doctors. Again, sounds kind of weird, but that's the time frame we're talking about here. People just kind of did things like that. And this appears to be the first time that she really finds out about dancing in public. She decides she really likes it, and then she claims that her ailment is cured because of it. So right away, she just falls right in love with dancing, and that's what she wants to do. Unfortunately, once she gets released from the hospital, she finds herself in a pretty bad spot. She has a failed romance, and at this low time in her life, she contemplates suicide. But it's under these circumstances that she is driven towards the Montmartre district of Paris in search of the bohemian lifestyle. She starts performing under her stage name of Jeanne Avril, and eventually she's asked to take over from La Goulue as the star of the Moulin Rouge show. The show, by the way, was called the Can-Can Review. Now, Boudon's performance was very, very different from Weber's. Weber's shows were often described as being boisterous. They were very loud, very raucous events. Boudon's shows were much more subdued. And you often see those performances that Boudon had as being melancholic. That's how a lot of people have described her shows versus Weber's. Boudon's personality during the show was one of innocence and corruptibility, especially when compared next to La Goulue's performances. And even the physical figures of these two women were very different. You had La Goulue, who was a larger woman, and you had Jeanne Avril, who was much more thin and petite. In the end, though, it really didn't matter, because Jeanne Avril was just as popular as La Goulue was during her time. She'd go on to experience much more success. She'd actually go into traveling shows, performing in London and various other locations around Europe. And she'd also earn this nickname of Crazy Jane, although it's not really clear why she got that nickname, but what is clear is that she really didn't like it. Avril was another favorite of Toulouse-Lautrec, and even if you compare the paintings of these two women side by side, you can see the differences. Now, you can also look up photographs of Boudon if you want to, and almost every photograph and painting I was able to find of her, she usually had a hat on of some kind. It was a very conservative hat. In the paintings, she always has this stoic look on her face, which is one of the things that people find very striking about Lautrec's paintings of her. One of the most notable things about the painting versus the photograph is that in the photographs, her hair is darker, but Lautrec paints her hair as being blonde, so I'm not really sure what was going on there. But you didn't just have the dancers at the Moulin Rouge. You also had all these other shows going on as well. And one of the more interesting early acts that they had was a man that went by the name of Le Petomène. His real name was Joseph Pujol. And I apologize in advance. I had to include this particular act because it's just so out there. But Le Petomène was what they call a professional flatulist. I'm sure you're already getting a very clear idea of what that means. But this is no joke. His show involved farting. The entire show is just him finding all these different ways to pass gas and make people laugh. Apparently, I read somewhere that he had some kind of unique control over his, bottom parts that caused him to be able to do that. And he'd also cover popular songs back in that day. He'd brag that he was the only man in show business that didn't have to pay for copyright. Again, I could not make this stuff up, folks. This is actually one of the acts that they had at the Moulin Rouge. In any event, you can ask a number of different people where the golden age of the Moulin Rouge ended. But for the purposes of this podcast, the golden age basically ended on February 27th of 1915. That's the year that there was a catastrophic fire at the Moulin Rouge and burned down the entire original structure of the building, including the famous iconic windmill. The club would open up again in 1921, and the legacy would continue on. It's still actually a place you can go to today. It's still open. It's still a nightclub. It's still a cabaret, although it's not clear if the place is still a brothel, and they used to have these big balls that they would do, but that ended a very long time ago. And during those balls, they were very extravagant. I was able to read that they would bring in nude women on, I guess, like Egyptian princesses. They'd be nude the entire time, and they'd be on, I don't know, flower petals or something like that. That ended a very long time ago. But the venue's been host to a lot of other shows in the meantime, between 1915 and the modern day. Some of the people that have visited and played there are Edith Piaf, Ella Fitzgerald and Ray Charles, Elvis Presley, Buster Keaton. The Moulin Rouge was always a place of magic, and it served a very important role in the lives of not just the patrons, but in the employees as well. So you're welcome to judge the moral qualifications of a house of ill repute like the Moulin Rouge, but what's true about it is that it served as a safe harbor for women like Weber and Boudon, who needed a new home and a place of belonging just as much as they needed a place of income. But whatever you think of it, the milieu of the Moulin Rouge will always serve as a paragon of creativity for the early 20th century. Thanks again for joining me this week, geeks. As usual, if you have any questions or comments, or you just want to straighten me out on something I got wrong, feel free to email me at nick@geekedonhistory.com or come on over to the blog at geekedonhistory.com. Don't forget to subscribe and vote on iTunes if you like us. Hopefully you'll join us again next time. And as usual, stay geeky.